all respondents as well. We did receive word from respondents' counsel that Attorney Matthew, is it Morley?
Morley.
Will proceed when it's your turn, 10 minutes, and Attorney James Kovacs, for 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And we did receive the respondent's motion to strike. What we would intend to do is address that in the order, which will come following the hearing. And otherwise, if the party's ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may approach and identify yourself for our record, please, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Van Dyke. I represent Morgan Moeller through his guardian and conservator, Melissa Rogowski. This case is an accident case. It's about an experienced farmer who works many acres, a couple thousand, over about a 12 square mile area, pulling an overly wide load on a county highway in the dead of night, while he has on his high beams, at least, plus the field lights, striking an oncoming automobile that is on the right side of its own lane of traffic, but within its own lane, traveling under the speed limit. In this accident, under these facts and the evidence presented, the jury returned a verdict in which they placed 45% of the fault on the farmer and 55% of the fault on the oncoming vehicle. This is perverse. The farmer who admits that he did all kinds of negligent things, violated traffic statutes, basically jerry-rigged his lighting system to eliminate a safety feature, and deliberately transported his load so that it was over the center line by not a little, but a significant amount, ended up having more fault than the opposing driver, who's really only causal fault, if you can even put any on him, is to not be able to avoid that load, failure to get around it. There were numerous errors in the...
What would you make, Ms. Van Dyke, then, of the evidence of that other vehicle which did manage to avoid the accident? What would you... Because I'm inclined to agree with you. Had I been on the jury, I doubt if I would have found fault this way, but I wasn't, and of course that's not the issue on appeal. So apart from the expert testimony evidence the defense provided, what about that? What about the other driver?
The other driver was following.
Okay.
He was...
You're saying he saw the accident, so obviously he was going to avoid it.
He obviously saw the accident.
Fair enough. That's what I thought, but I figured I would ask.
I mean, he saw it. I don't recall how far away he was, but certainly his lights were in view, and he could see the taillights of our car suddenly go off into a field, and he had to have been aware of those lights. He saw the accident happen, and the tractor stopped, which is something that did not happen with respect to the first car, which is Morgan Moeller.
There was testimony, expert testimony, about what was visible at various points away. And I know that Morgan's brother Wyatt testified, who was the passenger, and unfortunately not.
The only voice of being able to say what was visible from the car, Morgan Moeller doesn't know.
Right, of course not, yeah, due to his injuries. But was there an inquiry about whether there was any discussion in the car about what is this coming at us and what should we do? Because there was a lot of argument put on Morgan for his failure to stop or his failure to get over or his failure to do this or that, and I was just curious.
There's no evidence in the record about a discussion between the two. The questions simply were not asked. We relied on Wyatt's testimony to tell the story because that was the only evidence we had in terms of from the position of someone in the car.
Sure.
We move for JMOL, and I think I'd like to discuss the question of, is it a big surprise that we're contesting that the fault allocation is perverse? I hardly think so. If you look at the topic headings in our opening brief, the very first one, because there was no admissible evidence from which a reasonable inference can be drawn that Mulder's driving was more causally negligent than that of Zander, the plaintiff's entitled judgment is a matter of law. Now, we focused on the fact that there's no causal negligence on Morgan Mulder, because for JMOL, in order for you, for this court to grant judgment as a matter of law, since allocation of fault is a jury question, and it is important with respect to how do you, what do you do with the damages, JMOL would have to be answered, if that's the only thing we're going to be doing, from the point of view of judgment as a matter of law occurs if there's no fault at all on Morgan Mulder. And I believe the record is strong on that, because...
What are we to do with the expert testimony, then?
I believe if you look at the reply brief, where I ended up having to do math, which is not one of my favorite things to do, but I felt it was extremely important to do that math, because under the math was done... In terms of the description of where everything was, the math was done, all of it except how far over the center line was done by their expert using their numbers. And basically what you end up with if you do that is how much space was there available that it was possible for Morgan Mulder to have gone around the tractor. And it's his right wheel or his passenger wheel is a foot, basically a foot onto the gravel, over the past the fog line, past the asphalt, into the gravel of what fortunately for him was a 3-foot shoulder on a roadway where the shoulder, it's admitted by everybody, that the shoulder varies depending on where you are, from 1 foot to 3 feet. Mr. Lofgren's numbers say that's why he used the word maneuver. He didn't use the word swerve. That's why his answers to those questions say you had to slow down. If you slowed down enough to maneuver your way all the way to the right, where he's going to end up using his numbers is with a whole foot of that car on that gravel shoulder. If he had been in a 1 foot area, he'd be in the ditch. It's dark. It's pitch black outside of the lights, the headlights, and the field lights. And even if you completely discard all of the evidence that Dr. Lewis gave about the impact of those field lights, which, if you've ever seen them in the countryside, illuminate the entire field. From the driver of the tractor's perspective, it's great because he can see everything that's going on. From the perspective of someone coming at it, it blinds you.
Ms. Van Dyke, I'm assuming what you're just sharing with us, that's the sort of argument you or other counsel for plaintiff made
yes,
to the jury.
We did. And I'm ignoring that in my example in the reply brief. Forget all that. What was admitted by Mr. Zander was that his high beams were permanently on and that, yes, high beams interfere with your ability to see. So that's what we went with. So we've got a kid who's supposed to slow down enough when he sees a tractor that to him looks as it like it's in his own lane and is in its own lane. He's supposed to slow down enough to move over to the right in an area where sometimes the gravel's 1 foot, sometimes it's 2 foot, sometimes it's 3 foot, then it goes back to 1 foot. And he has to move over at least that far to not get hit by that gauge wheel. The test for causation and for negligence, causal fault, is when you're talking about avoiding an accident. Is requiring him to do that, to avoid being causally negligent, is that reasonable? Is that reasonable? And we posit that it's not. And the numbers that are in the reply brief are all their numbers and all their facts. The only difference that this, what turns out to be 6.92 feet over the center line, which was the question not asked of Mr. Lofgren, but which he agreed that if you used his numbers, you could figure out, which I did, and I give you the math, so you can check me, which is a good idea. It's more than halfway across the line. He, all he had to do was move over 3 feet.
Well, I don't want to presume, but I'm just looking at the district court's order on JMOL and, you know, just trying to look, because, of course, you know, the district court had to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict.
Absolutely.
And there was a lot of discussion of Morgan Moeller's failure to do something. And, you know, and that seemed to be a persuasive argument for this jury somehow.
I think
it wasn't just, you know, the distance and the width of the road, but it seemed to be, you know, he didn't make any maneuver to do anything to avoid it. He didn't stop, and there was evidence supposedly that he was driving faster and not exercising due care. I just, to the extent you can focus on that, that would be helpful.
There's no question, even if you believe that the jury believed that he didn't, you know, that he violated, he was negligent because he didn't slow down going uphill. That was one of the things they brought to attention. He was negligent because he was going too fast for the conditions, seeing this great big thing ahead that he didn't know what it was, with all the lights that we're now supposed to ignore. Even if you factor all of that in, it still has to be a cause of the accident. And
but does he have a responsibility to exercise due care under the statute? I mean, that seemed to be...
I think he did. I think both of them did.
Well, sure, but, you know, in terms of, is any fault attributable to Mr. Moeller?
I don't believe it is, because fault has to, the only thing he could have done would be to evade it. Mm-hmm. Because there's no allegation he did anything affirmatively to bring a hazard onto that highway.
Right.
Okay? He's being blamed for not evading it.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be what the jury has done.
Correct.
Yeah.
And all the reasons that I gave in our briefing with respect to the evidentiary errors, I think is the reason. I think that they just thought this reasonable farmer, we understand why he did what he did, and this was a druggy kid who was high, and he should have done something. Mm-hmm. And I posit that that's not the law. If it's not reasonable, stopping would not have eliminated the accident. Would not have. It wouldn't have been as hard a hit. It would have done, you know, impacted damages for sure. But that's not the issue. The question is he partly at fault for causing the accident? If he'd stopped, Mr. Zander testified that he was just going to go, and he just figured the other guy had to figure a way around it, and then he looked over his shoulder to see. I think it was his right shoulder, which I still don't understand. But he had no intention of stopping. He was just going to go. He had already slowed down to 10 miles an hour, but he was just going to keep moving, and that's what he did. So if our kid had stopped in the same position he was in, there would have been a collision. If he had slowed down and done nothing else, there would have been a collision. I mean, that's just fact. That's just the way it, that's just the way it is, given all the rest of the facts. The only way he could have avoided it, the only way, would be to go slow enough, which is a number that no one has talked about, how slow is that, under these conditions, to be able to maneuver, to use Mr. Lofgren's word, his way kind of over there on the right on the gravel. Use the gravel to go around it. Now, we, of course, were arguing he couldn't even see it, so how would he know? But let's just forget that. Let's go with what you have to do on JMOL. What else could he do? And was it reasonable to expect him to do that in the dark, how slow would he have to go, and what are the chances he'd miss and go into the ditch? How reasonable was it to expect him to do that? And the best test for that is take this kid out of the car and put a 35-year-old man in it or a 40-year-old woman in it and ask the same question. And I think the answer is it's unreasonable. And if it's unreasonable, he could not have avoided it under the facts most favorable to Mr. Zander, which is Jamuel. I mean, I'm out of time, but I rarely, in my practice, I don't think I've ever seen legitimately a case that calls for Jamuel on fault. And I've been practicing 1 or 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, Mr. Morley, you may begin. We'll note 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Morley. That's spelled M-O-E-H-R-L-E. I represent respondents Noel Zander, Carlos Zander, and Elm Grove Trucking. Mr. Kovacs is taking some argument time as well. I intend to talk more about the jury trial liability matters. Mr. Kovacs, I know, intends to talk about the joint enterprise issues, but I'm happy to answer any questions the panel has on any issue. Your Honor, I'd like to start by reading a passage from a Minnesota Supreme Court case, Martin v. Bussert. This was a case involving an accident at an uncontrolled highway intersection where the jury found that the car that was supposed to yield the right-of-way and the car whose driver admitted to never even seeing the car coming at it from its right, the jury only apportioned 20% fault of the 100% on that driver and 80% on the injured plaintiff who had the right-of-way. And the court says, it might appear inconceivable that Rita Bussert, the defendant, who was required to yield the right-of-way but drove into the intersection without ever having seen the other vehicle, was found to be one-fourth as negligent as the other driver. And then they discuss some facts that talk about inconsistencies in the plaintiff's testimony and questions about whether she made the right evasive maneuver. She said she accelerated to avoid the collision, but there were skid marks showing that her car actually braked. And the court ends its analysis and ends its opinion before affirming the judgment in that case by saying, when all of these factors are considered, the 80% to 20% ratio might seem unfair, but it is difficult to conclude that it is against the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. We just heard appellant's argument here saying that it's, I want to use her exact word, a perverse judgment in this case, because even though the percentages were close, defendant was found to be 10% more at fault than plaintiff in this case. Or, excuse me, the other way around. Plaintiff was found to be a little bit more at fault than defendant. On its face, to many juries, maybe to this panel, that might seem unfair, but according to Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, it's not anything but a jury question as to how the fault should be allocated in a case like this.
Mr. Morley, I'd like to focus in on the metabolite of THC, and as Ms. Van Dyke, it strikes one as believable in terms of what a jury might look at a situation here. If you've got a well-known farmer, and the phrase she used was a druggie, I can't remember the phraseology, but what we have, as I see it in the record, is simply a metabolite of THC, and it seemed like maybe added to it then was a history of chemical dependency or having been through a Rule 25 chemical assessment. But would you agree, at least on the face of it, number one, I don't know that any prosecutor would charge a DWI marijuana on that evidence. And isn't that really what the case law is looking at in terms of fault, is what impact potential intoxication? But we never really get evidence of potential intoxication because past treatment and past assessments have nothing to do with this, and we have a metabolite. Would you agree that that's a sort of evidence, at least that's what plaintiff's pointing out to, where the jury got off of the facts of the case to allocate and look at tangential evidence?
Well, I have several comments, Your Honor. First of all, we don't know, obviously, what the basis of the jury's decision was. They may have disregarded that evidence. We simply don't know that. Because there's plenty of evidence.
Was that a theme in closing argument?
It was mentioned in closing argument. I wouldn't call it a theme. There was not extensive discussion on it. Most of the discussion on fault in closing argument was about Mr. Lofgren's expert testimony. And that, standing on its own, is enough to show comparative fault on
well,
the plaintiff.
Well, you know, but getting to Judge Sleeter's excellent point, wouldn't you at least have needed someone to say, well, if this is in your system, it may affect your reaction time, for want of a better word?
Yeah, and one of plaintiff's treating doctors did say that, Dr. Fema, and that's discussed in our brief. And I'll go back to...
It could potentially affect. Nobody said it was...
Right.
A cause or impaired driving as a result.
So I'll go back to the beginning. There was an outline of some of the evidence relating to THC, but not all. The first piece of evidence that came in about potential intoxication came in during the plaintiff's direct exam of the very first witness. At this point in time, the defendant hasn't even stood up to elicit any testimony. They introduced the sheriff's report.
Don't you think that was because the motion in limine was denied? And they didn't want you to bring it out on cross, but rather wanted to bring it out themselves?
No, it was actually direct. It seemed to be more of a mistake, because after that direct examination, when that exhibit was, or I should say during cross of that witness, when it was realized that they mistakenly put in...
This is the police report we're
talking about. Yeah, the sheriff's investigation report, yes. When plaintiff realized that they had made a mistake by putting in the entire report and had not redacted certain parts out, they attempted to have it removed as an exhibit, but the trial court, of course, because the exhibit had been used to examine a witness, didn't allow that. So the exhibit had come in over no objection, and before defendant even stands up to elicit any testimony, we've got evidence that's going to the jury room that says that a marijuana pipe and rolling papers, and by the way, there's burnt marijuana residue in the marijuana pipe, is found in the vehicle at the time of the crash. So from there, there's testimony of, yes, the Rule 25 assessment showing habitual use fairly regularly, and that was done 9 months prior to the crash. There's testimony of Wyatt Moeller saying that the brothers both used marijuana. And then there's the urinalysis afterwards on the same day as the crash showing the presence of THC metabolites. So all of this combined is circumstantial evidence of potential intoxication. And the appellants point out in their materials that, well, it's not like blood alcohol. We don't have a reliable test. Setting aside the idea that they don't have expert testimony to support that argument, even if they're right, it highlights the importance of circumstantial evidence in cases such as this where there is potential intoxication by THC. If they're right that you don't have a test that can be done right after the accident that says, yes, you're intoxicated, no, you're not, you have to go by circumstantial evidence. That's all there is, unless you get an actual admission from the party that, yes, I was high on marijuana at the time of the accident. So this evidence comes in, and the jury is given a special instruction specifically identifying...
Which was wrong, right? I mean, she talked about blood, not urine. I don't know how you...
It talked about blood, not urine. I don't know that there's a juror out there that would parse that detail. I think the general idea of the instruction is...
You don't think there's a juror that knows the difference between blood and urine?
No, I didn't say that, Your Honor. I'm saying that no juror... especially because they weren't educated during this case on it, no juror would know what the significance of the difference is between finding THC metabolites in blood versus urine. So the jury is instructed, especially, that this THC, yes, they use the word blood, but generally being found in the system is not by itself evidence of comparative fault. So the jury then, of course, is given the general instruction that it's up to you how much weight to give any evidence. So they've been given this evidence, and it's up to them to give it weight, to not give it weight, and we don't know if they did. So even if, and it's our assertion that this was properly admitted evidence, even if the court finds that it was an error to admit that evidence, it's not more prejudicial than probative. Because we simply don't know that that was the basis of the court's, of the jury's findings, because there is so much other testimony from Mr. Lofgren, specifically, about Mr. Moeller's failure to evade this accident. And yes, we agree with plaintiff. That would be the basis of the finding of negligence on Mr. Mueller, but that's the same as in the Martin case. The court said one of the possibilities in that case that the jury found is that the plaintiff, even though they had the right-of-way, failed to evade the accident, and maybe that's why they had more fault put on them than the defendant.
Yeah, but that factually didn't involve a vehicle that protruded into the opposite lane of traffic, which intentionally was done and improperly done.
That's true, but
I just have one question about there seems to be sort of an undercurrent of trying to paint the Mr. Mueller in a certain way. What was the need for the evidence that his girlfriend had spent the night? I don't understand what relevance that had.
I think the inference you can take from that is he possibly didn't get much sleep. That's one of the things that could be relevant because it is before 6 o'clock in the morning. He's a teenage kid. I know when I was a teenager getting up that early, I wasn't feeling the greatest, even if I had gotten a good night's sleep. So you can infer that, and it's shown in his driving conduct. I mean, his driving conduct, he didn't react to an obvious hazard in the road. Then maybe he was driving drowsy. So I guess that would be the inference. But the last point I want to make very quickly is that a lot of discussion was about the lights on this tractor, and I see in the reply brief they equate this to a semi coming down the road with its brights on. This is not the same. These field lights go out in all directions. This would be a tractor lighting both shoulders of the road, all the road behind it, including the plow. So it's not the case where Mr. Mueller is coming up on what looks to be a semi with its high beams on. And with that, I defer to Mr. Kovacs. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Kovacs, you may approach.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is James Kovacs, and I represent respondents John Bruns, Diane Bruns, Dustin Zander, and Elm Grove Land, LLC. And as Mr. Morley pointed out, I'm going to focus my comments on the joint enterprise issue, which was tried to the district court prior to the personal injury trial. The parties in this case dispute whether or not the farmer defendants were engaged in a joint enterprise. And the parties also dispute the standard of review this court should apply to Judge Model's determination that they were not engaged in a joint enterprise. Because whether or not a joint enterprise existed in this case was a question of fact to be determined during the bench trial, this court should review Judge Model's March 16th order for for clear error, and in doing so, affirm. Just last week, this court issued an opinion in Peterson versus Western National, in which it set forth the applicable standards of review following a bench trial. This court does not set aside a district court's factual findings unless they're clearly erroneous. And while this court will correct erroneous applications of law, the district court's ultimate conclusion is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. With that in mind, from the beginning of this case, appellant has argued that whether or not a joint enterprise exists is a question of fact to be submitted to the fact finder, either the jury or, in this case, Judge Model sitting as the fact finder. In response to our motion for summary judgment, appellant argued that both elements of the joint enterprise, there were material disputed facts with both elements. And those elements, which are themselves undisputed, are set forth in the pattern jury instruction 30.65, which states that a joint enterprise exists when two or more persons have a mutual understanding for a common purpose, and each has a right to a voice in the direction and control of the means used to carry it out. Now, the first thing is the fact that there's a pattern jury instruction shows that this can be a factual issue in some cases, which it was in this case. If this was purely a legal question that was decided by courts in every case, there would be no need for a pattern jury instruction.
What would you say is the key factual differences then in this, and I believe it's the auto owner's case, was it the 94 case that appellant cites that indeed a joint venture was found and affirmed to be a joint venture?
Yes, Your Honor. So the district court in its findings in the March 16th order specifically addressed the auto owner's case. And I'll quote from page 8 of Judge Model's order saying that the current case differs greatly from the facts in auto owners, end quote. In auto owners, what the court found was that the farmers made collective decisions as a group. And then once the group made a collective decision, each individual farmer was bound by that decision. They were not free to ignore it. The difference is in this case, Judge Model found that each farmer had a different purpose for farming, that they were independent farmers. And specifically, John Bruns, the grandfather, had retired from farming by the time of the accident, so he was not even an active farmer. And then the active people who were still active farming, Noel and Dustin, They were, and I'll read again from her order, this is on page 8 going on to page 9, Noel and Dustin were free to ignore each other and make independent decisions on how to farm and the manner in which to do so. So, Your Honor, Judge Model read the auto owner's case and specifically distinguished it after she saw the evidence and testimony of the parties. I will say, though, Your Honor, even if this court is not persuaded that this is purely a factual question in which Judge Model resolved the factual disputes, then what appellant is actually contesting is the ultimate conclusion. And if you go back to appellant's post-trial motions, in her reply brief, she used those exact words, stating that she was requesting the court to, quote, revisit its ultimate conclusion. And that's document index number 431 at page 14. So even if this court is not persuaded it's a fact issue, then the court needs to review Judge Model's determination for an abuse of discretion. And I submit that Judge Model did not abuse her discretion, particularly given the factual findings she made, which appellant does not challenge, which I stated to you before. So unless the court has any other questions for me, regardless of the standard of review this court applies, this court should affirm Judge Model's March 16th order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kovac. And Ms. Van Dyke, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you. I'm going to do it backwards first just because I don't want to not address the joint enterprise issue. The argument about there were disputed issues of facts in the trial court level, that was done because there were disputed issues of fact about all kinds of things. And there was a bench trial to find out what those things were. And there were extensive findings of fact by the trial court that we have not challenged. Then the question becomes, okay, who decides how you round those facts up and apply them to the two factors? And when you're applying them to the two factors, what are you doing? Is it finding a fact, or is it a conclusion of law? I posit it's a mixture, because in many cases, you don't have to have a full-blown bench trial to figure out what all that long list of facts are. But at worst, in terms of standard review, it's a mixed question, because you're taking this huge laundry list of facts and you're deciding whether or not, if you look at all of them, is there a common purpose? So we're not challenging the facts. We're challenging how the judge applied the law. And she made a couple of serious mistakes. One is the common purpose. The common purpose in joint enterprise law is very loose. They just have to agree. It can be an automobile ride, you know, a trip. That's what all the original cases were about, one trip. So what she did, if you look at auto owners, all those people had separate farms too. I mean, they were separate farms. They weren't the same farm, just like in this case. You have to look at what they did together. What did they have in common, and is it sufficient to create a joint enterprise? You don't look for at all the things that they do differently. I mean, in this case, it's pretty simple. They were all working in common, and there were lots of examples of that, with an understanding that they're going to try and make sure everybody's successful in their farming. It isn't a question of who pays taxes and whether they have separate insurance policies and whether that's simply not it. And I really want to address the control issue, because this was a big error, I believe, on the judge's part. Really, if you look at her reasoning, the control issue is, does somebody have veto power? Can someone veto, you know, who's the boss? Who gets to veto? And if there's no one who has veto power, there's no joint enterprise. Well, if someone had veto power, there wouldn't be a joint enterprise. Joint enterprise is a cooperative venture. And that's what this was. And if you look at auto owners and the
what exactly was the cooperative venture?
It's making sure everybody in the family's farm was successful, that they did a good job.
If that's the only definition for a common enterprise, then, I mean, I would think every farmer in America is involved in a common enterprise, because I think I mean, I don't think anyone is out there saying, boy, I hope he goes under.
Well, I think that, we're, this is different than your neighbor. You know, I'm going to go plow your field for you because you're sick, okay, which happens. Is the second factor, all right? Neighbors don't meet the second factor. They just don't. And this case, and this is important, and they participate. They have a voice in the direction and control of the means, okay? They have a voice in how it gets done. And they don't always win. They talk it over, and someone makes a decision. And then they share. And that's how they use the machinery in this case. It didn't matter who owned it. And the machinery is what's at issue in this case. That tractor and that plow. And this, just that day, you've got a perfect example of a joint enterprise. You've got dad who decides to help out his kid by turning over a field that they had discussed how they were going to do it, and grandpa got outvoted in how it was going to be done. But you've got the equipment on grandpa's farm that dad gets up and says, I'm going to go over there and I'm going to do this for my kid. And he, you know, puts it all up. And dad doesn't just own that. He shares it. It's a joint thing. They all use it. And he goes out on the road to plow the field for his kid. And that happens all the time. It's the second factor. It's a right to a voice in the direction and the control. And my time is up, so I will have to leave the rest of it to my briefs.
Thank you to all the council for your comments today and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling, and we will proceed now with our non-oral calendar today. Everyone have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.